Introducing the Macallan Horizon, a collaboration between the Macallan and Bentley Motors. This limited edition release features a unique 180-degree twist vessel reflecting the horizontal trajectory of the automotive world. Representing a shared legacy and marking a milestone in two brands' pursuit of uncompromised excellence. Register your interest at themacallan.com. Please enjoy the Macallan responsibly. Don't drink and drive.
Hello, we're back. This is Everything Else, the FT Culture Podcast. Welcome to Series 5.
This week we'll be talking about the Football World Cup. What are our hopes for Russia 2018 and what are we dreading?
And later I'll be speaking to the groundbreaking choreographer Akram Khan about his latest work, Xenos.
Everything Else is going to be fortnightly so we can bring you more great guests and discussion.
Al, welcome back to the studio.
Thank you.
It's very nice to have you here.
It's extremely nice to be here.
So you're off?
Yes. We had a baby and the baby was born with a very, very rare genetic mutation called diamond black fan anemia, which means that he can't make his own red blood cells. So I was off dealing with lots of hospitals for several months. But apart from not being able to make hemoglobin, he's absolutely tip-top. And he's a very happy, oddly handsome little boy called Rufus.
Rufus looks extremely handsome in the pictures I've seen of him and extremely sweet.
Thank you. So we've tweaked the podcast a little bit. It's now a sports podcast.
Is it?
Well, this week it is. We'll be looking at Russia 2018 tournament that you're most excited
that
about.
That I'm very excited about. So everything else has taken a kind of sporty turn for the worse, for the best.
No, for the best. And and football is culture anyway, isn't it? So it belongs on a culture podcast.
What do they say? The beautiful game.
Yeah, like a beautiful painting.
Or a stage.
Indeed, it's
a
like
great
a stage.
Drama playing out before us.
Which is good because Sarah Hemming is about to come into the studio to teach us all about football. Sarah is an FT theatre critic and contributed to the magazine's brilliant football special a couple of weeks ago. She wrote about the great Uruguayan Luis Suarez. And that issue was edited by Neil O'Sullivan, who will also be with us. He wrote about Mesut Özil, the German playmaker. Neil is a great expert on football, as you are too.
I am, as you are about to hear.
Great. You can find all these pieces at ft.com/World Cup. Thank you for coming in. First, I think we should gauge general levels of excitement for this World Cup. How excited are we, Neil?
Very excited, actually, yeah. I've had quite a bad season watching my club team, Arsenal, and I'm hoping that this will be a relief after that. And
just the ticket.
Yeah, just give me some enjoyment from football.
By the quality of the football or the quality of the drama?
The drama more than the football. I think a lot of the enjoyment out of the World Cup doesn't come from seeing brilliant teams, but from the moments that are created.
So you'd say maybe a 10 out of 10 in terms of your own enthusiasm?
Certainly.
Is that sit about right?
It's getting
right?
That way, yeah.
Is that the same for you, Sarah?
I try to avoid getting excited because it's the hope that causes ultimate despair, of course. It's the hope that kills you. And this morning I heard the football commentator utter the dread words, cautious optimism about England's chances. And I thought, oh no, here we go. You can't help it. There's something very exciting about the World Cup. All that enthusiasm, all those teams turning up, all those fans, all the kits, all the nonsense that goes on around it. Yeah, I am.
So you're a 10?
My excitometer is going up. I'm probably around about 8 now.
Okay, good. And same for you, Chris?
Well, having read Neil's special issue of the magazine, all about the World Cup, I'm now pretty excited. I have to say, I was not excited beforehand, not being a football fan.
Okay, so you'd say maybe like a 4 out of 10?
Yeah, tops.
Okay. Well, okay. Well, I'm a sort of lukewarmish sort of 7 or 8, I think. Uh-huh. I don't really care about England because I was brought up in Scotland, so it used to be that I just long for England to go out as early and as humiliatingly as possible. Now I don't really care about them so much because I haven't really heard of most of the England team, which is a relief because it's not... Previously it was that sort of golden generation of John Terry and other sort of slightly unattractive people.
But so I think Neil has heard of them.
There are just a few.
Yeah.
So you'll be nervous then, Sarah, because of you want England to win.
Do I want England to win? I don't want England to lose too humiliatingly, perhaps. I mean, maybe that's one of the interesting things I think about England in recent tournaments has been the kind of constant fine adjustment of expectation levels. And over recent tournaments, one of the things has been watching my children slowly get inured to disappointment with each passing tournament. They used to get so excited and they used to get all dressed up and we all used to go around to each other's houses and it was brilliant. And then gradually, you know, you got used to sort of carrying sobbing children home and they gradually sort of grew hardened. And their primary
school... But that's useful, school, isn't it? Because that is... That's the experience of life, isn't it?
Yeah.
Increasingly disappointing.
The trouble is, as I said earlier, I think it's just that you start off, I'm not going to be nervous, I'm not going to care, I'm not going to care, it's just, and then you get sucked in, don't you? They have one good match and then you get all excited again. It's the awful roller coaster.
Is that what you're feeling as well, Grizz?
I mean, I can relate to Sarah, to your children, because the last time I really properly engaged with football was World Cup 98. I think I was 11. And David Beckham being sent off the pitch for kicking somebody, which I felt was deeply unfair. Now, actually, having reviewed the YouTube footage, I think, yeah, fair enough. Probably shouldn't have done that. I mean, I sobbed. I cried for days. I wouldn't get out of bed. I was absolutely distraught.
Are you okay now?
Yeah, I mean, I've just about recovered. I've put 20 years between it and, I'm back.
Will you be nervous, Neil?
Not really, no. My parents were Irish, so I was a foot in two camps.
Yeah.
So I was always a bit ambivalent
about it.
Neither
camp that good, though.
Neither camp that good, yeah. Sort of hedged my bets in a way that was completely useless. But I think what Sarah says, like cautious optimism is better than what it used to be, which was incautious optimism.
But why did we have that?
Back in 98, you know, you had players like Beckham, Rooney, and you had Gazza before that. So you always had sort of superstar celebrity players, and we thought that they were the best, and that therefore England were the best, and that we actually thought we could go there and win the tournaments. But each time it kind of like went wrong in sort of variety of ways. There were high expectations and then there was high disappointment, whereas now there are definitely lower expectations.
Why are England so bad at football? We have good players, we have an expensive league, they have nice training pitches, and the FA has good facilities. Yeah. Why?
Well, I don't know actually that we are that bad. We're under 17s of the world champions last year. Under 19s, I think, are the European champions last year.
Does that normally translate?
That is the issue, really, is that we didn't used to, I think, win those tournaments. But what it suggests, I think, is that there's a problem where these kids are now as talented as the foreign kids used to be. It's not a problem of technique, like it used to be said that the English players weren't as good technically. I think the youngish players now probably are sort of on a level technically. But what happens between 19 and the national team is that a lot of the players don't get the chance to play at the top level for the top teams. And so their development is still...
Because we have better foreign players.
One of the reasons is that, the top teams just buy £60 million right-backs. You know, someone like Alexander-Arnold at Liverpool, who's a 19-year-old local kid, that is very much a rarity. And sure enough, he's in the squad. He's got into the England squad after his first season. So if you get the chance, I think those kids are good and they could come through. And we might see, because they've been taught in a way through the levels that has helped them to win tournaments, they could maybe win tournaments again.
So what are we most hoping for out of this World Cup?
One of the things I love about the World Cup is it's a fantastic sort of circus, a festival of football, if you like, but it's all the sideshows, all the wonderful things that go alongside, like, you know, the famous three yellow cards. Actually, what I'm most hoping for is another animal oracle, like Paul the German octopus who could predict matches.
Predict any result.
In 2010. And he was amazing. And apparently he got all the results right, certainly all the Germany results right, and became an absolute celebrity. I mean, this is the sort of mad thing that can only happen during
then
the
then ended up on someone's plate.
He was so accurate about Germany beating Argentina, apparently, that an Argentine chef posted online an octopus recipe.
It's a bit harsh,
so
isn't it?
It's the sort of craziness of it, I think. And the heroes and villains. Mm. The heroes like that Mexican goalkeeper, last tournament, I think it was, Guillermo Ochoa, was it? Who had a madness of a game, an absolutely sensational game against Brazil, and ended up on the front cover of Time magazine and things like this, and became an internet meme.
So you talk about heroes and villains. Is there a kind of theatrical element? There's all the ingredients of a good drama. As a theatre critic, do you see football in the same way?
Well, yes. I mean, there's that funny thing, isn't it, that often as a theatre critic, what you go to see is a play that you know what the ending's going to be, but it's how you get there. In football, it ought to be the opposite, but actually it's generally the same. It's the old thing of Germany winning in the end, isn't it? But yes, it is. It's the antics along the way. And it's the yes, you do get heroes, you get villains, you get an enormous comedy. You get outrage. I mean, the ghost goal in the game between Germany and England. Was it, which year was that, Neil? Was that,
I think
2010?
It was
2010.
South Africa.
When the whole world saw the ball cross the line, but the ref didn't, so it wasn't given. Yeah. So there's, you know, all the comedy, the crazy commentary as well. There's, do you remember which one it was, Neil, where there was one of them had Ronaldinho, Ronaldo and Reinaldo all playing, and one of them scored, and there was a fabulous bit of commentary from a very, very excited Brazilian commentator who went... Ronaldinho or something like that, and it's all that. It's that's what I love. It is, yes. There are opportunities for arias and all sorts.
And it's not just about good football, is it? No. It's very often not. I went back through. I've been watching World Cup since about 1986, and all of the standout moments are basically sort of either something non-football related or something really bad, like Maradona's hand of God goal, or Beckham getting sent off, or you know, things like that. Beyond that, given that it's in Russia, presumably we all want a little whiff of scandal. I mean, I don't want doping really, or
matches like to be fixed.
But Russia's obviously very good at coming up with, you know, misbehaviour stories of their own. Do you think we can hope for that?
Russia lose 5-0 and it...
And they start poisoning people.
5-0, they win.
Yeah, they just change the result. Oh. Because, I mean, it's true that they are the worst team, aren't they, apart from maybe Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, they're the lowest ranked apart from Saudi Arabia.
So that's an exciting opening match then, between Saudi Arabia and Russia.
And in fact, yeah, there's some sort of suggestion that they might have been given that match because it might be one that they can kick off.
It's the only one. Why are Russia so bad?
10 years ago, Russia were actually pretty good, and they got to the last four of the European Championships in 2008. And one of their teams won the UEFA Cup that year. They were good then, and then they kind of got quite a lot of money came into the game, I think, from oil. And I think they maybe just kind of went a bit mad on the money. And one of the things they apparently did was paid the homegrown Russian players too much money, which meant that rather than go to leagues that were more competitive abroad, they stayed in Russia in easy street and didn't develop as players. And now they're kind of seeing that that's kind of had an impact on their national team.
So it's a shame to be so bad if you're hosting it, isn't it? It's embarrassing.
It is. The only team that has gone out in the first round that's hosted it was South Africa in 2010, and that's kind of different case because Russia have actually...
A bit more international goodwill for South Africa.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It would be interesting to see or to watch Putin and how he...
When is he a football fan, do we know?
Hockey is his game. Ice hockey. That and sort of riding on horses. I suspect he, like any world leader, he's a football fan when there's a World Cup going on in his country.
So, Chris, what are you hoping for?
I mean, I have fairly low expectations. But yeah, some scandal would be good.
You're hoping for England to do well or get knocked out early so that people stop talking about it?
Well, like you, Al, I also grew up in Scotland, but I don't harbour...
Hence the accent.
Huge resentment for the English team. I'd quite like to see them win. I guess the best outcome for me would be if this World Cup unlocks a lifelong passion for football.
Well, you're about to marry a passionate football fan, so that would
help. Well, exactly.
Help,
so I think, you know, I should start
winter
now.
Yeah, you could watch Match of the Day together.
Yeah.
And what are we most dreading?
Well, one of the things that I'm slightly scared of is it being a bit boring. I think, like, the European Championships in 2016, I think, were uneventful in the way that we're saying that what we really like is these kind of, like,
That's because we were all getting swept up in for voting for Brexit.
It might have been, yeah. One different thing about the World Cup now is that everyone being a bit more familiar with different teams, different countries, different players from different parts of the world, there's less that kind of feeling of culture clash about it in the way that you used to get. teams like Uruguay used to turn up and you knew nothing about any of the players, you'd never seen them before, and then they'd come and kick the living daylights out of your team. You'd be really surprised and sort of appalled and everything. But whereas now, you know, we know who plays for Uruguay. They all play for top teams in Europe. As a result, you know, they're all a bit more pally and there's less kind of needle, but there's always Sergio Ramos to supply some of that.
I'm hoping Argentina are going to win, just simply because
put it out there.
Because I want Messi to win. I think that would be a nice drama, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
but I'm dreading, the one thing I hate is the reprisals. You see, you know, when Rob Green, do you remember he 2010 was it, let one go through his legs, and it's just poor guy, I don't think, just ever recovered. And he's like, I looked him up just before we came on. He's like, he's not even in the first 11 for Huddersfield. And then there was that Colombian back who scored an own goal and then he got shot for it. You know, I think the reprisals, like if you don't do well, I think it can be a desperately lonely thing being watched by hundreds of millions of people.
Well, yeah. Beckham got terrible stick for that sending off back in 98, didn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, he was kind of
pilloried
for weeks
it.
After. Griselda started the backlash and it just rolled on from there.
But then he came back and he captained the team, didn't he?
Yeah.
So you can come back from it. I mean,
Beckham could come back from anything.
And social media has quite a short memory, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Should England be going at all, given, you know, the poisonings going on in Salisbury and elsewhere? Do you think we should be going? We should be boycotting and saying no to Vladimir Putin.
As we all know, sport rises above politics all the time.
Okay.
The only thing, I mean, I think in terms of dreading, what you were saying, Neil, is the boring, actually. I do remember watching one England match. There were two commentators and one of them said, I can't think of anything to say. Can you think of anything to say? And the guy said, I can't think of anything to say either. It was so dull. I mean, it would be good to avoid that. It's penalties as well. I think penalties are so cruel, aren't they?
Penalties
are the bit of football that I love. Yeah. I mean, you don't really need to know anything. It's just, is it going in or not?
Yeah, the drama is reduced.
It's a sort of like, you've got two options and
so
tension.
Really, if you miss that. I mean, you know, the shame of it. I mean, should we be going? Well, everyone else is going. I suppose we better turn up, hadn't we? I mean, really.
But at least then
we're going to win, aren't we? Come on.
At least then we wouldn't. If we didn't go, then we wouldn't lose humiliatingly. We would have the moral high ground. Finally, who's going to win, Grizz?
Well, Mexico, obviously, because that's who I've got in the sweepstake.
Okay, it's a long shot. That. It would be a great result for Mexico if that happened.
And for
Neil,
me.
I went with Spain. Last week in the magazine, I almost went for France, so I'm going with Spain or France.
I got France in the sweepstakes, so I wouldn't mind if they,
I'd love someone like Iceland or something like that to win. Or Egypt, obviously, with the wonderful Mo Salah. But in the magazine, I thought Brazil would win, so I better seem like I know my own mind. And yes, I think Brazil probably. I think Brazil is certainly in with a strong chance this time.
Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So, Grizz, you've interviewed Akram Khan.
Yes, Akram Khan is one of the most exciting choreographers working in contemporary dance today. He's British, grew up in London, of Bangladeshi origin, and his style blends Kathak, which is a classical Indian dance, with more contemporary movements. I went to see one of his shows last week called Xenos at Sadler's Wells. He's 43 now, and this was actually his last full-length solo performance. I've seen him quite a few times, so it was quite a poignant farewell. He's on the stage by himself with musicians, but he's really the only dancer. He's telling a story of a dancer turned soldier in the trenches in the First World War from India fighting for Britain and what it was like to be a colonial soldier. So he's a sort of everyman character.
Was it good?
It was really striking. One of the things he does really well is the overall stage picture. So scenery, colours, costumes. He dances with these kind of traditional bells strapped around his ankles and he uses them almost like musical instruments. He's worked a lot with artists, Anish Kapoor, Anthony Gormley, and he's got this very visual sense. I don't think all dancers and choreographers do quite, and he's kind of noticeable because of that. I went to an exhibition actually that he curated himself in Manchester a few years ago, and he'd brought together all the artists who he loves, and they're all people who are interested in the body. And all his shows, like Xenos, have this very striking rich colours, amazing, very strong lighting. They're very emotional, political in this case. The idea of what happens to a soldier after war, how we look after soldiers, what the psychological impacts might be, and especially someone who's not fighting for his own country. Xenos is now on tour and worth catching. It's going all around Europe and then we'll be at the Edinburgh Festival.
Wonderful. Let's listen.
Akram, thank you so much for coming into the FT.
Thank you.
I want to start by talking about Xenos. Can you tell me what drew you to the stories of these colonial soldiers who fought for Britain in the First World War? What was it about their stories?
I think it was several things, really. One was anger. One was curiosity. That drew me towards their stories.
Because these are not stories that
were told.
That we really know about.
No, yeah. And we never studied it in school. We studied history. But it's a whitewash, really. You know, there's a saying, until the lions have their say, the hunters will always tell the story. The victors have always written history.
Mm.
But they've also edited history. You always get one perspective or several perspectives, but not a 360 perspective. Xenos was really inspired. The initial inspiration was the story of Prometheus. We wanted to relate it to a particular war, and First World War was somehow the backstory, if you like. But somewhere through the process, it took precedent. Prometheus became the backstory and got absorbed into the colonial soldier story based in the First World War. I think partly because of timing. There was one article that said, I thought remembrance was a white thing. And it was a guy from India who works in this country. He had done some research about his grandparents or great-grandparents, I can't remember. And basically he discovered that they were involved in the First World War. And I kind of clicked with that because I always thought that was a white thing. Even though I'm not really so conscious of colour. I'm really bad with colour, especially when it comes to costumes.
What do you mean by that?
I'm a bit colourblind, I think. I don't differentiate things with colour. You know, when I was a teenager, I was working at my dad's restaurant and there was racism. There was a lot of racism in the late 80s, early 90s.
So this was in South London?
Yeah, South London, where I grew up. Yeah. And in the summer holiday, I would work for my father in his restaurant. I remember thinking of my colour then, but then I didn't think about it because in dance, somehow, there are less walls. I'm not saying there aren't walls, but there are less walls than there are, for example, in theatre or film.
Why do you think that is? Why does the real-life racism of the outside world seep into theatre more than it would into dance?
I don't know, actually. For me, it's something to do with the body. Even if it has a cultural reference, it's also about the spirit. Somehow the body is universal for me. Also in dance, there's this power of to explore ambiguity. In theatre and film, perhaps, you have characters. Okay, this character is this colour. He's from this background. And so you're looking for specific looks and types of people. Whereas the power of ambiguity allows you to be kind of colourless, really. Even gender I have an issue with, because only until recently have I been focusing on gender. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. It's about, do you speak to me through your body more powerfully than somebody else? If it is, I'm taking you.
So you wouldn't choreograph differently for a female dancer than for a male dancer, necessarily?
Now, yes, because I work more with characters. But previously, no. I was kind of in the realms of the androgynous. I'm not going to talk about the ballet world because I don't know enough about it. But I definitely feel in the contemporary dance world, there's far less racism. I have so many actors, friends who are actors, who maybe look Middle Eastern, but actually they're Italian. And, you know, they would say, oh, I'm just waiting for my next terrorist role.
Mm.
There are huge issues in theatre and film with actors, but in dance, perhaps that's what drew me. I felt free somehow in the dance.
I think it's interesting that it feels like in the British theatre scene in the last, say, 10 years, we have been moving away a little bit from this kind of traditional reliance that we have on text, and we've been embracing more European directors and styles and things. And at the same time, contemporary dance has become a much bigger thing than it was 15 years ago. And I wonder, in a way, if audiences are becoming more used to a different way of watching something that's quite different, that's more abstract, that's not about these very fixed characters and about words?
There is a shift. There is a bigger interest in the contemporary scene. Perhaps people don't want to be told what it is. There is the power of choice. When you see a contemporary performance, dance performance, if there's 1,000 people, you're going to get 1,000 different perspectives. Whereas when I do classical work, it's very codified. And there is a narrative usually that people know. They already know the story. So there's nothing to invent. It's like reading a book and watching a film. When you read a book, the character you visualize is your interpretation of that character based on what you're reading. But when you see a film, it's given to you.
And yet, with your Giselle, which has proved so popular, you were taking a traditional ballet that people know well and they love, and making it very different and giving people quite a fresh interpretation.
Yeah, I think from what you're discussing, let's relate it to Xenos.
Mm-hmm.
Because Xenos means stranger or foreigner or alien. In Greek, i.e. xenophobia. When I was creating Giselle, there was this kind of rise of xenophobia, particularly in that period. And also there was a huge migration of people from Syria and from that part of the world. And the sense of being displaced became very evident. We have a very specific interest in those countries, particularly their material. And so we create chaos and they get displaced when they need support. We turn our back. So my work is more and more connected to the present. I don't want to just say political, but it's in the present. The Giselle that I saw, the classical version, which is beautiful, but first of all, I can't imagine a girl being like that because I grew up with bloody feminist women all around me, like my mother, and now my wife, and my daughter's
and you have a daughter.
Five, mm-hmm. And she's definitely not the typical Giselle. She'll whack you around and beat me up and all that. She's a very strong character. So three females in my life, particularly my mother. You know, she was a feminist. Since I was born, I remember her being a feminist. So when I see Giselle, I don't see her as sweet and coy. Not that that's wrong, but that's from a male perspective. And I think a lot of mythological characters, females, are written by males. So it's how men want to see women. And so I didn't want to see Giselle in the way men wanted to see women. I wanted to represent my mum or my wife. You know, I wanted to be able to fall in love with someone who's strong and who's fierce and fragile.
Has becoming a father changed your relationship to the world? You talked about your work now being more engaged, not necessarily political, but more aware of things.
Yes, it has changed because they represent the present to the future. We have really messed it up. Our generation, yeah, and our previous generation have really messed it up for them. I had a really good childhood and the world was all right. It wasn't entirely all right, but it was okay. And now the cracks are there because we see ourselves in isolation from the other. We need each other. It's as simple as that. What happens in Syria, the repercussions arrives here, unfortunately. We think it's isolated, but it's not. But the new generation, there's really hope in them. They, hopefully with technology, take our civilization into a better place.
Well, there's a political awareness about people my age, younger than me, much younger than me.
Absolutely.
That feels
that was not there
hopeful.
Before. Yeah.
Mm.
Politically engaged. I was never politically engaged. Not in the way I am now, but the young generation, wow, they don't want our systems anymore that we set up.
There's a sense of overthrow.
Yeah, you know, like the Arab Spring, and there is the power in the people.
Going back to when you were young, when you were a child growing up in London, you learnt Katak dance from when you were quite young. Can you tell me about that process? Did you take to it immediately?
Not really. I didn't take to it. I did it because my parents told me to do it. I was really just interested in Michael Jackson. And Bruce Lee and Muhammad Ali and Charlie Chaplin. I love Charlie Chaplin. And I just wanted to do that kind of work, you know, that kind of physicality. Katak was too strict. You know, it was a classical form. I only appreciated it much later when I was in my teens, late teens. But funnily enough, it was just in that process of going to the class. Once I started the class, I forgot the rest of the world. Once my body started to move, it didn't matter.
Do you still have that feeling when you start to dance?
On stage, yes. Not so much in the studio. Not so much in rehearsal or practice. But on stage, yes. I forget the world around me, not who I am. I feel at home. But off stage, I feel a foreigner, stranger.
And Zenas is your a sort of farewell to performance. It's your final solo.
My final full-length solo.
Yes.
But not to performance. I'm definitely not stopping performing.
But it's a stepping back, if not a farewell.
Absolutely. Absolutely. From full-length solos, yeah. I'm tired of negotiating with my body. My body's too cheeky and too just really naughty.
It doesn't do what you want anymore,
no,
necessarily.
No. It does everything I don't want to do. It just wants to rest all the time. In all seriousness, I feel a kind of a strong resistance from my body for full-length work. I mean, short bursts of dancing, it's fine for me, but not an hour to carry an entire show for an hour and 5 minutes is hard.
One of the things that you're known for is collaborating with artists from outside the dance world. So Juliette Binoche, Anthony Gormley, Anish Kapoor, these people who have worked with you. Is there something that people can bring from outside dance into a work that you're creating?
Oh, absolutely. They bring so much more than one can imagine, even composers. But particularly, I mean, composers and dance choreographers, of course, go together, but visual artists or filmmakers really teach me a lot. It's about 360, right? Perspective. History, I was talking about, should be 360. We should hear all the angles. We should see all the angles. Only then can we understand the center of it.
So thinking about, you know, what a sculptor might bring to dance.
Yeah. So even a cup, for example, I will look at the movement of it or the shape of it. A sculptor may look at something else from their artistic perspective. The composer perhaps may look at the sound or try and discover the sound of that object. We're all talking about the same subject, but we're coming in from different angles.
Can you tell me a bit about the process of creation? Does it take a long time to make a new work?
Yeah, it does. To my company's dismay, but they're very supportive. I take a year to come up with something and collect or gather a team of collaborators for that particular subject. Once we've collected the team, we're all continuously throwing into the Dropbox our thoughts and ideas based on that subject. Images, poetry, text, films, anything that surrounds that notion of that subject. And then the third year is the creation. And even then I take around 12 weeks. But even before that 12 weeks, in that third year, we have this thing called playtime, play period, where we literally bring all the images and ideas into that room and explore without a sense of trying to create it for a production. We just play like children. And then we spend 12 weeks preparing it.
Which is your favorite part of the process?
The beginning and the end. The middle's the hard work. But I love the beginning because anything is possible at that moment. And the end is because nothing is possible. You're there. The middle is just bloody hard work.
Akram, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's it for this week. Akram Khan Zenos is touring to France, Spain and the Netherlands before coming to the Edinburgh Festival in August. You can find all the dates and buy tickets at akramkhancompany.net.
And you can read all of the FT's World Cup coverage, including pieces by our podcast guests Neil and Sarah, at ft.com/World Cup.
In our next episode, we'll be looking back to 1968 and what protest looks like 50 years on.
And Al will be speaking to the Scottish comedian Fern Brady as she prepares for her show at the Edinburgh Festival.
If you'd like to be in touch, we'd love to hear from you at facebook.com/everythingelsepodcast or by email everythingelse@ft.com.
And if you like what you hear, please leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts.
Everything Else is produced by Chica Ayres. We've been Grizz and Al, and our music is by Fatima.
Introducing the Macallan Horizon, a collaboration between the Macallan and Bentley Motors. This limited edition release features a unique 180-degree twist vessel reflecting the horizontal trajectory of the automotive world. representing a shared legacy and marking a milestone in Two Brands' pursuit of uncompromised excellence. Register your interest at themacallan.com. Please enjoy the Macallan responsibly. Don't drink and drive.